We need him to zoom on in on me.
If you're watching on YouTube, let's get it on. Yeah, look.
It does look like proper pink eye, though.
Not looking well. Ironically, when I wrote off that van, I also crashed the hire van that they gave me in place of it. First renewal after that was $5,500 for the year.
So it's a little bit dodgy, started to go dark, no lights on in the building at all. I said, hi, I'm Ollie, I'm from Manchester. And the guy looked at me and he went, are you a soldier? And I just went,
you're a big unit, aren't you? I bet you genuinely scare people.
Yeah, I'm a big bloke. Doesn't mince his words, does he?
Right then, let's get going. I'm not going to do it today because it's becoming a tick, I said last night. So, season six. And we have got, first off, we've got a guest host. We've got Gav. Gav's come to stand in for Al.
I'm like the Timu version of Al.
Yeah.
The Wish version.
Yeah.
The shit version.
Definitely. While Al's off sunning himself in Dubai?
Abu Dhabi.
Is that near Dubai?
Yeah.
Dubai, then. Al's in Dubai.
I thought it was just like, yeah, same regional. Same part.
Same part.
Where have you just come back from, Mark?
I've been to Mexico. Is that how you pronounce it? Mexico.
Mexico.
Yeah, it was there. That was absolutely lovely.
Hence you're still by, looking quite tired.
Hence why the dry roasted peanut effect that I've got going on. Yeah, I do tend to, the first 3 days I go bright red raw with just sheer sun. And then I go to like this tanned Adonis that my missus likes to tell me. I think it's all bullshit, but.
No, I saw the beach pictures.
Yeah, they were just for you.
Lovely. I really enjoyed that.
Nice.
Especially the hammock one.
They weren't as good as the bedroom pictures.
So, yeah, we've got Gav on as a guest host tonight, standing for Al. And we've got Ollie from Stabila.
Well done. That's good.
And we've got Tom from Gardenscape.
Had to double check there, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I had a quick look down at your breast. Gardenscapes. No, it's just Gardenscape. Gardenscape Wiltshire on Instagram.
Yeah, Instagram, TikTok. Everywhere, really.
So we've got, obviously, Ollie, levels. We're going to talk all things levels, measuring, equipment, and try not to make it just about levels and measuring equipment. We're going to give it some zhuzh. We're going to zhuzh it up, Ollie, aren't we?
Well, that's what you're here for, yeah?
You're more than just a bubble, Ollie.
Yeah.
More than just a level.
That should be the tagline, we're more than just a bubble. Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
More than just a bubble.
Might want to pattern that now.
Yeah, quick. Then, obviously, we're going to drop on to Tom and find out why his eyes are really bloodshot that he didn't want us to absolutely mention one little bit.
Thank you for these guys.
That's all right. So, yeah, do you want to get into Ollie first?
Ollie,
excuse the pun.
Yeah.
Didn't know it was that sort of show.
Wow.
Could go anywhere. Honestly, with him co-hosting, it could go anywhere.
You're from a gym company. It's all good to you.
Yeah, it's all good.
So, historical reference. That's what I like. I like historical references. Like, where do companies come from? Where do they start? You know, their backgrounds and your, like, how you ended up in that.
Well, it's over 100-odd years old, isn't it?
We are celebrating 135 years this year. So, wow. Yeah, 135 years have been going. That whole time, it's always been around measurement equipment, so always stayed away from trying to expand into other areas. Starting point of the company was folding rules. So one of the first ever companies to start making these when Europe started to go over to the metric system, then moved into spirit levels. They were first company painted acrylic vials. So you know, back in the day, they used to be glass.
So is Stabila the first company to begin making levels as we know them?
Well, not really, because sort of spirit levels in different guises have been going for hundreds of years. You know, and the principles of it go back thousands, you know, like the ancient Egyptians were using that sort of physics and technology to build things. So
controversially, did they really build the pyramids though? That's a whole different,
you tell us.
I go down massive rabbit holes with the whole pyramids things. That's for a whole new podcast, completely different podcast. Joe Rogan, come at me. I'll sit on there with you. But sorry, Ollie, yeah, carry on.
Yeah, I can't remember. I got
use that. The was, Egyptians it, using levels,
it
but
was the Martians so they go back. That built the pyramids, yeah. Wasn't it? Yeah,
I think it was.
Yeah. Yeah, so for 135 years, been making measurement equipment. Like the basis of companies all been about innovation. So you can look at something and think it's pretty simple, but the products that we make, there's over 200 different patents we've got on different designs, different parts of the designs that we do. We do tech levels, so digital levels, as well as laser levels as well. So it's kind of always been in the ethos that anything to do with measurement equipment, that's what our bread and butter is. And that's where we'll focus, we'll innovate, and try and be first to market with sort of best-in-class products. Kind of the reason, I guess the reason why they've been able to do that for 135 years is, like we always say, one of our taglines, particularly when we're doing training with people, is the single most costly mistake you'll make on any job, whether it's a small job or a really big one, is a measurement one, which we'll come on to later.
All too well recently.
Yeah.
So it might seem like a standard tool you have in your tool bag, but getting the right tools, the right measurement equipment is
massively key, isn't it? Every trade, I think, works with a level, whether it be vertical, horizontal, whatever, and is very much taken for granted. You use it as a throwaway sort of tool, but if you don't get something bang on from the start, like, you know, we'll touch on it a minute, Tom, but let's say for argument's sake, you did 20 metres of fencing and the first fence was, you know, a little bit out. Not that it ever happened, God forbid. But then it's you 20 metres in, and at the end of it, you know, you could, for instance, be a foot near on a foot out. Or, but no one ever do that.
But what's your tolerances on these then? So all levels, everything in that respect. So whether it be laser level, bubble level, everything's got a tolerance, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So what's the parameters for it? Because you have to, we go and level stuff up, like if we do rads or whatever, and you run pipework, you go level stuff up. But there is a tolerance on that. So what's the percentage to it? What's the...
Yeah, so the tolerance, say, like in this, is not, say it's 0.5 millimetre per metre.
So that's a little 2 foot level.
Yeah, well, that's pretty standard. Every single one of our levels, 0.5 millimetre per metre accurate. Sort of behind that, there's two points to make. One is, like with other measurement tools, so say a tape measure, they've got different class ratings. You have class one tapes, class two tapes.
Really?
It's all about like accuracy ratings of it. So, you know,
I just thought a tape measure would be a tape measure.
Yeah, but they have tolerances as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So your tape measure and your markings between each centimetres and millimetres, there's tolerances to those as well. But those class marks mean that you have to have a way of testing to get to those class ratings. Yeah. Now, with spirit levels, nothing like that exists. So, you know, you can put on a level it's 0.5 millimetre per metre accurate, but there's no class two, there's no CE mark that is like an industry standard to it. So it means that you can buy things that would say that, but there isn't any class rating to it.
There's no governing body.
Exactly. There's no governing body to
it.
And I think the second part is, you know, you can say it's 0.5 millimetre per metre accurate, but it's got to last, you know. So like, you could have bought that level that was 0.5 millimetre per metre accurate when you got it, but after use and after time, it can
even
it
then 0.5 over 20 metres is
it's a lot.
100 mil out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes a difference.
Yeah. And I think with the other thing, like with German manufacturing companies, they're very cautious and they're very particular and precise with things. So you go into our factories and every single vial is calibrated in the spirit level. And I'd say about 90% will go out at 0.1 millimetre per metre accurate.
Yeah.
But unless they could guarantee 100% were, they wouldn't go away from a standard 0.5. So most of them are actually better in terms of tolerance than that.
So with the German factory side of it, everything's built, made in-house. And when they're assembled, are they assembled by robots? Because I remember Liam, who works for you, an ambassador for Stabila, we spoke with him, didn't we? And he said, is it right, they're all hand-assembled?
Yes and no. So, like, different parts of it are. So the bit that's hand-assembled, so, you know, the rings that are inside?
Yeah.
All those rings are put into the vial by hand.
Every single
single ring. You know, you're talking millions of rings are put into the vials
of
by
all the
hand.
Parts, handling the rings got to be the hardest bit, surely.
Yeah.
It is. And one of my first times going around, I went around with the head of manufacturing, and you know, there's these incredible machines that are making vials, they're milling them, they're testing them really precise, you know, what you'd expect with German engineering. And then they will get these empty vials and a bag of rings, and people will come to the factory in the evening, and they will take these trays upon trays of vials away home, bring them back in the morning with all the rings in them. So you ask the question, going, surely there's a way, better way of doing this.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, we know the machinery we could buy to do it, but they're the main employer in quite a small town. Right. And I think it's about, I might get the number wrong, but I think it's about 60 people will come either every night or every other night to the factory, and they'll take them home. Most of them are people that are, you know, earning money while they're out of work, or earning money, you know, while they're at home looking after the kids.
Right, yeah, little jobs they can do.
Yeah, so just there's 60 people in the local community that make some money off it, and we'd rather that than find a machine to
so
do it.
So they're just sitting at home fitting rings.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Do you have one ring to rule them all?
So a company even as big as Stabila are literally still put back into the local community.
Yeah. It's nice to know
there's companies that are still working ethically and based around that kind of ethos.
What I would say, though, is you do to get, like, for them to make that worthwhile, they'll average getting that in like 8 seconds. They'll fill a vial 8 seconds, and they'll do it while watching the telly. Just bang. Bang.
Yeah, it's just second nature.
Yeah,
but I tend to find companies like that, with like Stabila, and just as the flip side of it, a British company. Me and Gav worked with the company Thomas Dudley, does the internals for toilets and that. They employ all local people from that around that area, don't they? And it's family generations going through working for the company. We went there, and you got the nan, the mom, the daughter, but they're all from that local area. Yeah. So with that. Again, like you said, Tom, supporting that local area is massively key. People forget these big companies are still, even though they're a massive worldwide company, they're still putting back, you know, little Ethel's coming at night and picking a vial up and her 60 rings.
You'll find that generational knowledge then will transition constantly, won't it? Because they do that within families. So that generational knowledge of, like, kids growing up, literally knowing it and seeing it, seeing their parents out there doing that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So that transcends really well then, isn't it, through generations. Like, it's not like kind of like automatic, like the, you know, you used to have family going to the factories and stuff like that all over the UK, and it was just, you know, your father worked there or your uncle worked there, so they would
carry on. You're saying is there's a small village in Germany somewhere where 5-year-olds are really good at putting the rings inside their
I would imagine
their hands have been like so they're perfect at fitting them in.
So moving from there then, a massive sort of company that puts into the local community. When did Stabila then branch out? I suppose that would have been after the war then, if it was it 1929 they started?
They started in 1889. So it was before the 20th century.
Right.
Well.
Yeah. Yours ain't too good. Yeah. We'll come on to that, Tom.
It's good effort there.
So the Stabila trademark was 1929, the official.
Yeah.
And then you had transition period then. So, yeah, it was the company's journey after 1929 then, as it went on to modernise to become what it was. So that historical transition there, like what was the period then of that and where it built to then?
Yeah, I think the big step change for them was post-war, really. And I think a lot of globalisation started happening, and that's where I think Stabila became more than just a German manufacturer of tools, and they were a global manufacturer. All of our levels are still made in Germany. Folding rules are made in the Czech Republic. But they operate, I think, in over 60 countries globally.
Just with the one factory?
So we've got a factory in Germany that does levels, a factory in the Czech Republic that does the folding rules.
Yeah.
And then we've got a joint venture in China that does the laser levels.
Right, okay,
So there's three owned factories.
But there's no other ones in, like, the US, and there's nothing in the UK.
No.
It all comes through.
Yeah.
Comes through that.
Yeah.
So then that period then of becoming more mainstream, and as the housing boom, I suppose, through the 50s, 60s, 70s, that's when it sort of really ramped up then, didn't it?
Yeah. And it's, like I said, it's, I think as global markets started opening up more, They found like big markets in the US, in the UK, in Australia, in other parts of the world. But a lot of that was predominantly done with partnership agreements. So, you know, you'd partner with a company in the UK and a company in the US. And probably only really in the last maybe 10, 15 years have they started to have their own people on the ground. So, you know, there's a separate sister company in the US now and a separate one in Australia. Really with the intention being of bringing like Stabila as a product and a brand closer to tradesmen. So for the UK, we only started directly employing people, me being the first, 2 years ago. So
really?
Yeah. Before that, it was we'd make in Germany, we'd ship over and we'd have partners that we'd work with.
But you'd have no sort of front of house guys like yourself, nothing?
No, not such, no.
Right. So then you
talk a lot about the brand that they don't actually need to be there.
Yeah,
shoving it down people's throats. It's already a household name. And there's not even anyone here.
It's the strength of the name, isn't it? Yeah. It's the strength of the name that's been built for that long.
I think it's strength of product, really. Mm. You know, you get that sort of longevity from good products and from trust.
But then, if you were going to ask for a label, it's always like on any tradesman, it's the first name that comes up, isn't it?
Yeah,
and it is always the first name that comes up.
Stabila is very much like the Hoover. It's not a vacuum cleaner. It's a vacuum cleaner, not a Hoover. But everyone says, where's the Hoover? The Hoover's the product, isn't it? The brand name.
Yeah.
The product is a vacuum cleaner. Whereas even if you've got a Shark, I'll go and Hoover upstairs.
Yeah.
That name is synonymous with that. And very much, I think, Stabila is synonymous with levels especially.
Yeah.
But you said you do measuring stuff as well, laser measuring stuff. And when did that sort of step into it then?
So Stabila were quite early in that. So, you know, the laser levels started to get properly commercialized in like the early 90s, and Stabila were around making laser levels at that time as well. We've sort of always been around and making them. But as it's become more and more mainstream, there's a lot more players in there. So, you know, your standard power tool manufacturers, they will all have laser levels. They can move really quickly to bring products to market. So I think the main thing for Stabila, particularly when it comes to technology, is if you're going to launch something, it's got to be right.
Yeah.
So you don't have to always be the very first to market with something. But when you do come to market with something, it has to be right.
Yeah.
And take that time to listen to tradesmen, listen to what they're going to use it for, and get the product absolutely right before it comes out.
We had a company on a couple of weeks ago. I won't say who it was because I don't know how much of it they'll want to say about it, but they're bringing something to market that's been around for a while, but they've looked at it, assessed it, and gone, it's a good product, there's no one else doing it, but we can just tweak that little thing because it's a proven formula, and then we can put our spin on it and make it better than that, which, you know, Stabila may have done, looking at laser levels. Right, we can tweak that, and then we can go with ours. Yeah. So they're doing the R&D, and you're doing an evolution of that.
Yeah, I think when you use a tool every single day, you don't have to always revolutionise it. Those little tweaks can be the things that can make a difference.
Yeah.
You know, if you're getting out of your toolbox and you're using it every day, you'll notice that something's a little bit lighter, or something's a little bit more durable, or a bit more visible.
Yeah.
You know, these things you'd be able to pick up on.
Yeah, I'm sure you've got something, Tom, that you've got that you've tweaked a tool, a shovel, or something, or you've got a go-to shovel where the handle's falling off, but you know
it's just that little bit sharper.
And everyone just tweaks that little bit to make. You know, we had plumbing. You know, your gas bottle. If you bend the end of the blow lamp a little bit because you prefer that way of it. It's all them little tweaks in it. You personalise it. And that's what you as a company, I suppose, are tweaking everything along the way. So there's always an evolution model of that level, the next one. And it was is it the H-bar?
Yeah.
The H-bar. Yeah. That's a Stabila product, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that, I remember them coming out, or my first memory of them was probably late 90s, and the guy that I was doing my apprenticeship with had one, and it was like, anything goes in the van, this goes in the top of the racking, out the way, it goes in its little sleeve, and he was massively passionate and didn't want anything happening with this H-bar solid level. And I was, that just sticks out in my head because he was so proud of that, or sort of put it on a pedestal because it was the first version of them, I think, that come out.
Yeah. I mean, those that design, most people call it like a girder level because it does look and feel like a girder. That's been unchanged for maybe like 50 odd years.
Right.
And it's the one we get a lot when we go to tool shows and tool fairs. You get like old boys will come onto the stand and they'll talk about one that they've got that is 40 odd years old, and that they're like, the colour might have gone on it, yeah, but it is absolutely perfect.
Yeah. And it's still true, yeah, with intolerance, the lot.
Yeah, they get really attached to them.
Are they the ones you use? I've seen you at the shows before where you put the bars up and you have the level either side, the old push-up challenge on it.
No. So
do you not use them?
No. Well, if you've seen the edges of them, you might shred your hands.
Health and safety of these shows is predominant.
Now, that's it's a product called the R-Type. So that's kind of the evolution of the girder level. You know, it's a big, strong, heavy level. The R-Type is sort of, it's painting technology. We're the only ones that make a level anything like that, that actually was designed with a couple of, I think it was bricklayers in Germany that designed it with us. It was their idea originally, and we took it on. But it gets its strength from the shape. So it's got, it's shaped like an R, and it gets its durability from the shape of the design, as opposed to just really thick, meaty.
Yeah, whereas that girder one is just thick. Is it steel? Would it be steel?
Aluminium.
Aluminium, yeah. For the girder one.
Yeah.
So that R design one is same aluminium,
yeah,
but just
hollow on the inside,
right? Okay, yeah. And that's an evolution of the girder one,
yeah.
And what's the evolution of that one going to be then, or is it still in that infancy phase of
still in the infancy phase?
Is it? Yeah. How long has that one been around then?
The R type, I reckon, maybe 6 years, something like that.
Yeah, and that's the one you always see, like the brickies. And the garden.
I was thinking,
boys.
It sounds like and one that might even be Tom-proof.
Tom-proof. Yeah. But yeah, you know, the big long ones. I mean, these little 2, 3, 4 foot ones for us as plumbers are perfect for rads. Yeah. But the brickies and the chippies and the roofers are the ones that get the big six footers and the 8 footers.
Yeah.
So with them, our ones are them.
They're popular, the 8 foot.
Are they?
Just because it's, you know, the longer it is, the more durable you've got to make it. But you don't want it to be really heavy either.
Yeah.
So it's that good balance of pretty lightweight but really durable and accurate at the same time.
So is the vials in them cast into the actual aluminium of it?
No, so they're it's probably actually the most important part of a Stabila level is it's not the vial, it's not the bubble, it's not the aluminium profile, because you just take a vial and stick it on a bit of metal, that doesn't make a level. It's the housing on the inside and how everything is combined. So
how it's supported internally.
Yeah, exactly. All this is hollow. And what's on the inside of here is a unique painted vial lock technology. So every single one of our vials, we calibrate it in the factory. So all of that is put in. You can move it around, get it absolutely right. And then you pump through this synthetic resin that hardens it. And it bridges it all the way from the very base to the top.
So it's completely encased in that resin then.
Exactly. And that's the same from the, you know, the Type 70s, the cheaper DIY ones, all the way up to the R-Types. Every Stabila level has the same technology in it.
Well, because you've showed us out there some other levels where you've cut open the front and you can see where them vials are suspended. What did you call it, Jack? They were floating. The vials looked like it was floating within the...
Yeah.
Where, so it's like got two fixed points, whereas yours is fully encased in all that resin. So there's, if you knock it,
it's not going to move.
It's not going to move at all, is it?
Yeah.
Well, which is kind of key with the level, isn't it? You want it to be bang on.
Yeah, especially if you're kicking them around.
We keep coming back to this, don't we? I mean, yeah, that's the exact problem I had recently, as we've discussed. And we will discuss.
We will, yeah.
But
yeah,
it's... caused me a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Let's leave it at that.
But it is key, and it can end up costing people a lot of money for something that is taken massively for granted. Is that how level is your level? And you'll always... I've done it. I've grabbed a level out of my van and I've held it against the chip. It always seems to be the chippy's level. The chippy's level is always the perfect level that's perfect, or you think is perfect.
So
I always get my level... Get the chippies level, Have a shot every time I say level. Get the chippies level and put my level on top to check if mine's right with the chippies. And it is, whether it's a Stabila one or whatever, the rule, or the sort of the unwritten rule, is the chippies level is always bang on. But now I know a little bit more about how a level works.
Could you flip it over though? So when you're leveling.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? That side,
180 degrees, that's it.
Yeah.
So I found something out, like a pretty cool, interesting fact earlier on this week. So we're talking about some marketing material, and I wanted to get it signed off by the team over in Germany. And it said at the bottom, made in Germany. And they said, oh, take that out and replace it with something else. I said, no. The made in Germany is a really important badge. And the head of marketing said, very proudly, he said, oh, that's funny that, because in 1886, he said, do you know where the origin of made in Germany comes from? He said, in 1886, the British government signed a decree saying that every product coming from Germany had to have made in Germany on it, because they wanted to make it clear it was of a poor quality. So it was all about, you have to buy British-made product. And if you buy from Germany, you're unpatriotic and you're buying an inferior product.
Ironic. How the tables have turned.
Yeah, you signed now it. You look for that made in Germany. Yeah. You know that it's, you know, everything's made to precision. It's done correctly. Yeah. You look for that now.
Yeah.
But you say that. Yeah, everybody is instilled with... The Germans, they build the cars right, they build this right. They're renowned for being that. But you've just showed us that in Germany, they don't use tape measures, do they?
No.
They use, for the people that aren't watching on YouTube, you know, how can you describe one of them? It's the old fold-out wooden...
It's a fold-out wooden ruler.
Fold-out wooden ruler. Yeah. And the Germans don't use tape measures, do they? No. They just use them.
No. But so my father, my uncles, everyone, all got these. They all use those. And all old school tradesmen I know have all got those. So even in this country, like, they've all got them.
Yeah.
And like, my father still, like, I've got his original.
Is it Stabila?
It's yellow, so I'm going to check.
Discolored in the Welsh hills.
Yeah. from the glorious sunshine. But like, from my father, my uncles and stuff, who worked in, you know, steelworks and things like that, they all use those.
Ladies and gents, just a quick one to say a huge thank you to our new headline sponsor, CT1, the best sealant on the market, voted for by the British public. Not only that, it's made in Britain as well, so go and support a product and a brand that is made in the UK. But I just want to say to you, they've got a brand new product out, which is the BT1. It's a combination sealant and adhesive like the popular CT1, but it's perfect for keeping a hygienic environment. And it's designed to completely stop the growth of bacteria, microbes, and fungus. And not only that, this stuff is strong. Now, it's going to be available at Travis Perkins, Wicks, Jusons, and pretty much everywhere else. So there's no excuse not to go and give it a go. So we're really happy to be partnering with CT1.
So getting on to you then, Tom, going away from the level side of stuff, let's hear a bit of your backstory. Where did it come from? What got you into it?
The trades as a whole.
Where, you know, obviously from school, did you get straight into it? Is it
not
running the family?
I'm very much the dark horse in my family. I started life as a chef and
really
was a chef straight out of school till I was about 21. And that for me was like the fallback. It was the easy option because it very much went in the family. You know, parents run restaurants. Uncles run restaurants. My brother and sister both now run restaurants.
Right.
I'm very much the odd one out.
Was that sort of put into you then by the family that you're going to go this route?
It was never pressured into me or put into me. It was just an easy job that I found.
You was always around it.
Yeah, it came really naturally. It was really effortless. Like to think I'm a pretty good chef without ever having to really try.
What sort of chef? What?
Well, everything was from scratch. Right. So it was always... literally made from base recipes. You know, you wouldn't buy pastry, you'd make pastry. It was all proper cooking.
Proper. Yeah.
And it was a lot of like English come French cuisine. So essentially the fancy side of what we do in this country.
Yeah.
It was more that kind of fine dining type stuff. And again, butchery, seafood, everything was all done from scratch.
So what's your specialty, Tom? This is what we need to know. What's your specialty?
Oh, that is a hard one because I'm a bit out of practice.
How old are you now?
I'm only 29.
Right, okay. So this was from school to...
So I actually started whether I should say or not, as 14,
yeah,
working in the restaurants, as a waiter, and when needed, stepping in as kind of a commis chef position.
Yeah.
And then gradually, as I got older, became a barman once I was old enough, and just didn't really want to have to deal with customers so much.
So you went out into
I jumped into the kitchen. By the time I left school, I was doing that full time, and making.
Done college? Really, do you college?
No. So again, if I wanted to, you can do apprenticeships in cooking. So I could have done that and could have got signed off and got all the certificates, but it wasn't.
Did you know then it weren't really what you wanted to do?
It was just a paycheck. Yeah. You know, it's a great life skill, and it, you know, I earned a really good wage at a really young age. My now wife and I bought our first house when I was 21,
right,
based on the income I'd earned from being a chef. And I was sous chef of a restaurant that did kind of 200 to 300 meals a night, which is a pretty big place. Right. Sous chef essentially meant on the head chef's day off, I was running the kitchen.
Okay.
At 19, 20. Which was.
Is it just like carnage in a kitchen?
It's.
Is it as bad as you see on like Gordon Ramsay's?
Saturday night, mid shift, it's full hell's kitchen, effing and blinding, things getting thrown and chucked. And
really? It's that bad?
Really bad. It's really, really stressful.
That would just do my head in. I could not work. I would be like, fuck this, I'm off.
Well,
no one's shouting at me.
That's why I don't do it anymore.
Yeah.
That's the long and short of it.
Is that what it does?
Essentially, it just ground me down. Yeah. Cooking pun intended.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was the best of both worlds in a sense. So in the morning, you'd be doing a lot of prep work. You'd be making the recipe kind of side of things, making things taste great, making sauces, making pies, that kind of thing. Come evening, when you've got all your grumpy, miserable customers sat in the restaurant, then it's just full out, flat out, just grafting, running around, just dripping in sweat because it's so hot in the environment, but also you are physically running around that kitchen. There's no
people pause. Screaming at you as well.
Yeah, and if you're running the kitchen, you're the one doing the screaming. And it's not necessarily a vicious thing. It's like, I need you to hear me, and I need you to not mess this up, or it's going to cause a whole lot of pain.
Has that always been the how it is in kitchens? It's not just been glamorised by the TV. It's always been that high pressure.
I think it is glamorised to an extent, but there is that kind of peak time where everyone is under that stress and is under that pressure. And it's not so much, I'm not shouting at you because I hate you.
Yeah.
You know, I'm shouting at you because I need the fucking oysters right. Doing. Yeah, exactly. I need that steak cooked that way on that plate right now.
Yeah.
It's not a
case. It's timing, isn't it? Cooking's all timing, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, on a Saturday night, you'd have six or seven chefs. Everything has to be on that plate at the exact right time. Exact right temperature and the exact right standard.
Yeah.
And then you've got to make sure the waiters and waitresses take it to the exact right place. Yeah. So it's a lot going on, and that's why the kind of stress and high intensity comes into it, I suppose.
And you was like, this sent for me.
No.
So you're 21.
You've 21.
So you bought your house with your missus.
I kind of hung on with chefing to get the mortgage before going self-employed. As we all know, it's tricky to get a mortgage when you're self-employed, and I took a huge pay cut as well.
Did you know where you wanted to go? Did you know?
I knew where my passions kind of lied. You know, I always wanted to be hands-on and building things. I grew up saying, I'm going to be an architect, but I didn't want to put that much effort in at school. So I didn't want to be an architect. I wanted to be building the houses. So I went from chefing. I probably took a pay cut of around 60%.
Right.
So I was back to earning literally a labourer's wage. And then within a month or two, I wasn't a labourer anymore. I was doing, you know, a lot of full-on.
But you must have had good skill set to be able to come out of that and to go straight into, I assume, what you do now, landscaping.
Yeah, I didn't actually go straight into landscaping.
Okay.
So, rewinding a little bit, my A-levels were product design, graphic design, and fine art. So it was all creative stuff, hands-on stuff. Product design, in my particular school, was essentially woodwork, metalwork, plastic work. It was learning to use tools properly.
Yeah.
So I had that kind of background. And then I always had my granddad that I looked up to as well, was like a master carpenter. So he was always he wasn't ever actually in the trade, but he was always in the workshop. And he was always teaching
whittling,
me.
Whittling, isn't it? They call it a whittling in the shed at the bottom of the garden.
I don't think that does it justice. I mean, he had like a four car sized garage that was like every man's heaven.
Yeah.
the perfect.
I can smell that. I can smell it now.
Oh, the smell of sawdust.
Yeah.
Which I'm a bit too familiar with at the moment. We'll get on to that one. So I always looked up to him and spent as much time with him as possible. And I did learn a lot from him over the years. But it was always just like, I'm not happy. If I stick with Sheffield, I'm going to be doing it for the rest of my life and I'm going to be miserable.
Yeah.
Or make a change. And that was it, really. We got the house and it was time to not only make a change for me, but we, by that point, had a baby on the way. And so it was like, somehow I need to spend more time.
Yeah.
I want to see my kids grow up. Little did I know, running my own business now, it probably takes up more of my time than ever. But for a while, at least, I had quite an easy, 8 to 4.
So why skateboarding? To go from what you did into skateboarding?
Yeah, like,
so they're poles apart.
Yeah, they really are. So the in-between was working as a general builder. So I did that for 3 or 4 years, and I essentially learnt my skills. I learnt my trade. I learnt to bricklay. I learnt a lot of carpentry, a lot of first fix, second fix. I learnt every aspect of what we do in the trades, bar plumbing and electrics. Because
how did you learn that then? Just on the job?
I was just really paired with someone who was willing to teach me. He was a really great guy, and he was very, very knowledgeable. And because...
See, that's gold, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Finding that guy.
But it did go a bit sour eventually.
Right, okay. But just to find someone that's willing to show you all those little bits, then little bit, again, back to the chef, all them little bits of ingredients. See what I've done there? All those bits of ingredients that then give you that platform to be able to go, right, I've tried all of that, that bit's for me.
And that's exactly how it went. So learning a lot of different skills and learning the trades as an overall, I then knew where I wanted to go. I knew that I wanted to avoid insulating and plasterboarding, and in general, the interior stuff is not really for me. The really intricate, fiddly second fixing, fitting kitchens, that kind of thing, I still do it occasionally, but I do it reluctantly.
Yeah.
I just wanted to direct it towards my favourite elements, and that all wraps up into one nice career as a landscaper.
Yeah.
And then also lacking the kind of creative output meant that by getting myself qualified with a garden design course through the Open University while working as a general builder.
What was that, like a night thing then?
Yeah, it was literally all online. So it's a university that's entirely online. Every evening, I'd more often than not have this newborn asleep on my lap while tapping away on the computer for hours. So I kind of felt like I then had the design knowledge and I had something on paper to kind of back me up. Because anyone can say, oh, I'm a landscaper, but are you?
Yeah.
You've got to be able to kind of prove your knowledge. So that was my way of proving it, I suppose. And by doing that, I then got to bring back my creative side from chefing to an extent, but more from like my education. So the fine art, the graphic design.
Yeah, all sorts.
I now do the complete package of garden design, create the amazing garden of your dreams, and then carry it out and make it a reality.
So you sit with the customer and go, right, you gauge what it's like when we do a bathroom. Whenever you meet a customer, you can sort of know where they're going to go, whether they're going to go an old style Victorian bathroom or a modern fucking grey thing that everyone seems to have at the minute. But you would meet a customer and you know these are going to want an easy to maintain garden.
Top of everyone's list.
Yeah, as opposed to a completely astroturfed.
Yeah, so, I mean, that is your easy to maintain.
Exactly, but, slabs and astroturf.
There's everything in between. Some people do just want it to look great all year round with zero effort. Other people want to be out there on a weekend. They want to be, on their knees in the flower bed. And you
really
ask them the right questions to make sure you get an idea of what they want. And then execute that in a way that it actually meets their budget as well, which, let's be honest, is the hardest thing. Materials nowadays are extortionate. So often by working with me, instead of saying, this is exactly what I want, how much is it going to cost? It's going to cost a lot because everyone has really grandiose ideas.
Yeah.
If you're a little bit flexible and let me perhaps have a bit of input, make a few changes, swap a few materials for alternatives that might save a bit of money, I get to kind of mould the garden to more my style, but also something that suits them better budget-wise and just keeps everyone happy, really.
That's going to be easier as well than someone who's like an avid horticulturalist.
Yeah.
Who has shrubbery knowledge, you know, seasonal plantation, stuff like that.
Yeah.
That's, yeah, in that respect, it's going to be a lot easier for you to go, well, you know, to have the customers who want you to take over.
Yeah.
To set it all. And you do CAD design and all that as well to go with it?
Yeah, so I don't get too heavily involved in the CAD stuff. I tend to do 2D as opposed to 3D, yeah. which is a lot less time consuming. So it's kind of like in-depth written descriptions combined with a visual that they can then read and kind of understand fully. Which is partly because then they know what the design is, but also they know exactly what they're paying for.
Yeah.
And they know where the costs are going and what I'm actually going to be doing for them. If you ever cross your wires, that could be, you know, catastrophic. But the horticultural side is a side I'm constantly trying to learn and build on. And I've got the basic knowledge and I've got enough to kind of advise and steer people in the right direction.
Mm.
But I would never, ever pretend I'm any sort of expert. You know, very much hardscaping is my forte, but I can advise on the soft side of things and I can point people in the right direction. And realistically, more often than not, people want plants that can look nice all year round.
Yeah.
They don't need a lot of look after. And it's quite generic. A lot of people want the similar things. You know, going back to your wish list that you get from a customer, low maintenance is always top of the list for right. everyone.
Yeah.
It's right up there with the budget.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
it's they don't, if they've got the most amazing garden in the world, when you've got the weather, which is rare, you don't want to spend all that time looking after it and essentially working on your garden.
You want to be sat in it, don't you?
You want to have a nice cold beer and you want to have a barbecue. Yeah.
Do you think that's it? That's become a generational thing, though, a modernization thing? Because if you look at previous generations, it, you know, every family was like, you know, there was a horticulturalist in every family.
Yeah.
There was that hanging baskets up, you'd have, you know, boxes and their gardens all pre-grown grass. And like generational wise now, so it's changed massively. And it's the same with sort of that minimalistic effect.
Yeah.
Like you have
it's the fire pit in the middle, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the fire pit, the little walkway down, it's the slab there.
The white rendered planters.
Yeah. You can literally sort of caricature an Instagram garden, if you like.
But again, creating what you see online in reality, it always costs more than what people think.
Oh.
And that's where I come in and just try and make it user friendly, so to speak, and actually make it possible and meet the requirements. Otherwise, I'm going to waste my time on a quote that they can't afford.
Yeah.
You know.
I think you sort of, you can gauge a customer, can't you?
Yeah,
they
absolutely.
They think it's going to be $5,000 and you know what they're asking is going to be $15,000.
I mean, nowadays it's, to do a whole garden, certainly you can't do it for $5,000. It's just, I mean, if it's a very small garden, then maybe, but.
Yeah. It's a window box.
Just to include all your, balcony maybe.
Yeah.
Couple of daffodils and you're all set. There you go.
Yeah, that's job done. Just go around daffodils. His garden, pluck them
so
out.
So Welsh.
So you've made that transition then from, so you've got your young family, your chef in, on the cusp of going on your own.
Yeah.
At what point, what's the conversation like with the missus then when you're going, I'm getting out now, I want to do this? Was she massively supportive? Or?
She was. She's amazing. She's my biggest supporter. She's my biggest fangirl. I think she saw what the stress was doing to me as a chef.
Okay.
And she very much was like, yeah, you're right.
You need to get out of it. Right. Was it that bad?
Get out
then?
Before I lose you to this kind of stress and madness.
You find that a lot with tradespeople, with businesses, even though you hadn't started your business then, that career was completely swallowing you up then.
Yeah. And ironically, I changed careers to get out of that. But now running my own business, you know, you're back in the deep end again and your phone never stops. You've always got emails, you've always got designs, quotes, you've always got stuff to do.
But I dare say the rewards are different then, though, because it's because you're
your own,
actively choosing that, aren't you?
Massively.
And it's something I enjoy. You know, if I'm sat coming up with this amazing, beautiful garden design, that's almost like entertainment to an extent. I mean, when it carries on and you're still doing it at 3 o'clock in the morning and you've got to be up at 6 o'clock the next day, it's not so fun. But it, as a basis as what I do, I enjoy every element of my work.
Yeah, because you've got a visualization at the end. So your reward is the visualization of what you've created. So what you see in your mind, and you're then putting it out on canvas, literally.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Yeah, to see my picture in reality is amazing. And I love it. And it does give me a real boost.
So what about the woodwork side of it? So, like, I tend to watch a lot of like Japanese carpenters. I like Japanese carpentry and from what they do externally.
Yeah, exactly. Really, really
Yes. Japanese carpenters are the best in the world. Sorry to the UK carpenters.
Really? It's a dovetail joint, is it?
Yeah, it is.
They create buildings that move in earthquakes out of wood, and they've been up for hundreds of years. They haven't. They don't fall.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they're all spindle. Japanese carpenters are the best in the world. So their external works, woodworks, are phenomenal. It is, it's so interesting.
Really impressive.
And how they do it. And like, because you're like the realm of what you're doing now, and you're doing that, and people are wanting these bigger projects and stuff, you then have the opportunity to push your boundaries a bit more then, and try new things.
I think that's what social media's done for me. I've only really been on social media just over a year now. It was just before Christmas last year that I started. I didn't even have a personal Instagram account, let alone a business one. I still don't have a personal one. I went straight in with a business one, and I've kind of managed to somehow muddle my way through and get it going quite well. But by always showcasing what I do every single day, if I think it's boring, someone's going to find it interesting. It doesn't necessarily mean it is boring.
It may be boring to you because you do it day in, day out.
And that's it. And that's what I always have to remind myself. It's like, yeah, okay, I've done this 100 times, but that person watching it might have never seen it before. Yeah. So it is interesting to someone. But it also makes me push, as you were saying, it makes me push my boundaries and makes me want to just not only one up my competitors, but to one up myself. You know, if there's any way I can make something better, I'll do it.
I was watching I was watching you route down beams.
Okay.
I was like, do you know what?
In the last few days.
Watching that video, I thought, so you have people who like, especially if you stage in a garden.
Yeah.
So they're staging off and you've got your oak beams, whatever it is that you're using, and to the next stage. Like watching you route to that section, I thought, do you know what? I've not seen anyone else do that, especially on the staging. So that's really nice.
There's 2 points from that. Firstly, you've fallen for the trap. It's not oak. It's dark stain.
For that one.
It's soft. Pabs, it's softwood sleepers. It's what I was coming back to earlier, where I can make a budget suit someone better.
Yeah. So they wanted the oak look.
That's it. So they wanted the oak look. Instead, we got a normal sleeper with a darker stain. Mm. And it's costing the same as a normal sleep, but it looks like oak.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that's worked. But the whole like routing the edges and things like that that's just me. You know, that's not in the quote. That's not a detail they've asked for. That's like
your personalization.
If I spend the time running the router along this edge, it's just going to be a bit nicer. There's going to be no splinters and it's going to be a bit more special. And then the drip lines underneath as well. Again, I routed the drip lines in because sleepers, although they're all damp-proofed on the backside, they can still get a bit of moisture in them on the front side. Because it's England and it seems to rain all the time, but it'll still go green eventually. Whether that's 5, 10, 15 years, it will start to go green. Mm. So I've just done the drip lines like I would with a brickwork wall and the copings on top of that. It's not hard, you know? It's maybe added half an hour onto my day, max. But if those sleepers are now not going to go green, that's a half hour well spent.
Absolutely. You know? But that's what sets you apart then, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And it's
the little bit you'll go.
Yeah.
So you've set your business up, and how are you then getting the work in from you doing your general building stuff, and then you made that transition to do that?
I had a bit of a blurry period in the middle. Obviously, when you first start out, you don't have a name, you don't necessarily have photos or a resume or anything to really show off. So I started off doing it 3 days a week while working another dull job just to pay my bills.
What was that?
I was a delivery driver.
Was you?
Yeah, so for Amazon as well.
I was just going to ask, was you in Amazon?
Yeah.
But there's good money in that.
Yeah.
So for 1 month, I worked doing that for 2-3 days a week, and then landscaping for 2-3 days a week. Back then, it was mainly my fence has blown down in the storm.
Yeah.
You know, it was really remedial stuff. But by the end of that month, I was booking up 4 weeks at a time, and as soon as I could, hand them a keys in kind of thing.
Really?
Ironically, I would have made really good money as a driver.
Yeah.
And I was probably getting 2 or 3 grand a week just delivering parcels.
Did you ever go, oh, should I just stay doing that?
Problem is, I kept crashing.
That'll do it.
Yeah. At one stage, I had 6 claims on my driving license within 5 years.
Is that on your, would that
and
be on you
then?
Month
period.
Yeah, was that on their
my license and it was my van.
So you were subbing out to Amazon?
Yeah, essentially. I was self-employed, so it was your insurance policy. My van, my insurance policy.
So using 6 claims?
6 claims, all within that kind of month period.
Are you just a shit driver?
Yeah.
What was you hitting?
Everything.
Really? How can you do six?
In fairness, two or three were not my doing, but they
never
still,
is, Tom.
Exactly.
Never is.
But there was one big old write-off in that. I had a lovely long wheelbase transit, custom, really nice, leather
should have
interior.
Bought German Merc.
I mean, I have now, but it was really nice van, and I, you know, spent all my savings to get the van because it wasn't a van for the delivery driving; it was a van for the landscaping business. You know, a nice van, get it sign written, come across well, all that kind of thing. Yeah. And I wrote it off after about a week or two.
what did you hit?
The back of the Nissan Navara, which had a really big metal bar on it,
yeah,
and it barely had a scratch. And then,
do you drive tippers and stuff around now?
Yeah,
through houses by the sound of it.
Trailers more often than not, and normally towing a kind of 10-foot-long trailer as well.
You're right. When was the last crash you had?
Sorry.
When was the last crash you had? Amazon.
Amazon. Yeah.
Just what, into that, Amazon headquarters?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
There's one down the road. Be careful.
I mean, ironically, when I wrote off that van, I also crashed the hire van that they gave me. In place of it.
Cruise insurance must be insane.
Oh, it's got to
be. It was. First renewal after that was $5,500 for the year.
Wow.
And then it came down more or less $1,000 a year.
Oh, that was good.
And now it's about 800 or so, but I should be paying like a couple of hundred now.
Yeah.
Did they give you a black box like they do with teenagers where they started?
Yeah. Thankfully not, because then I'd probably have my license gone. So that was my kind of interim period.
So you was doing a little bit with Amazon to
just to cover my bills.
Yeah, which probably ended up costing you a fortune.
I would have come out of that month with a nice bit of savings had I not had so many incidents.
So you must have got enough work in then to go, like you say, hand the keys in and then you're away.
Yeah, exactly that. So by the time I got myself a replacement van, I was good to go and start doing it full time. So obviously, once I was kind of hit the ground running by that point, probably not too long before COVID hit as well.
Okay.
So then I'd start to get a bit of a reputation. Suddenly everyone's at home with spare cash.
So how long had you been going then before COVID hit?
6 months, perhaps.
Right, okay. So really...
Now I'm only at about 5 years.
Right.
As Gardenscape. COVID hit. Suddenly everyone's got disposable income.
Of course they have, yeah.
They're spending loads of time in their gardens, and it was perfect for landscapers, really.
So you're doing right over COVID.
Yeah, so COVID basically meant I built my business, built my reputation, and then coming out of that, I've always been 6 months ahead, booked up kind of thing.
Are you in where you are, is it quite a small local area you work in, or do you travel?
We do and we don't. So we tend to travel when somebody's heard from word of mouth. So my cousin, an hour down the road, really wants their garden doing, and they love ours. Can you go that far?
And you're happy to go that far?
To an extent. I mean, let's be honest, you've got to make sure it's worth it money-wise, because you're going to be spending a fortune on fuel. And you're going to lose probably an hour every morning, an hour every evening. So that's got to be kind of reflected as well. But as long as people are happy to do that, then I'm happy to travel, really. But I'm so busy locally, I don't need to. No, that's it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people that will travel a lot for work and because they've got the work. But I'm very much similar to you. All my work is really, I'm busy local, so I don't need to travel. If I had to, I would.
Yeah.
But I don't need to. Yeah, exactly. It's overheads and all that sort of stuff. So you're through COVID, you're doing all right, and then you're sort of up to present day now. At what point did you go, let's have a go on the old...
The social media.
Yeah.
Wow. It was Juice and Live. I could tell you exactly what day it was. It was Juice and Live 2022.
Right.
And Dave Elwood.
Good old
Dave. Let's not give him any more credit because he doesn't need his ego build up anymore. But.
So you've just gone to Juice and Live as a show?
I got taken by my local Juice and they said, come in the car with us, take for a day out. Basically, yeah.
And no social media for you at the time?
I had Facebook.
Okay.
I had a business page on Facebook, but we're not talking like posting content. Yeah, yeah. We're talking, here's the garden I've just finished.
Yeah.
Quite like dull remedial stuff. But it was essentially a catalogue back then of, here's my work, you know, this is what I can do. I can come do it for you as well, kind of thing.
Yeah.
After speaking with Dave and Alex from Aerial Carpentry and a couple of others that were there at the time, basically got convinced into giving it a go. At that point, what did I have to lose?
Yeah.
You know, if I couldn't be asked or it didn't really work out, I'd just sign out, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just been a whirlwind since, I suppose.
Yeah. And it's that where people who are in it in the social media side of stuff, telling others to do it. It's like, I don't know, it's Stabilia's social media. They're quite active on social media, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I say our mate Liam, he's an ambassador for you. And he puts stuff out and Stabilia is sharing it. And then you're getting your product out, the same as you doing the gardens, you're getting your product out. I always say, if people aren't on it, and Al will say it as well, we always bang on about social media on here, but it's a massive scope. Why would you missing that many people?
It's almost got to the point now as well where, like, if you're not showing your work, why are you hiding?
Yeah.
You know, because so many of us are now online, it's unusual now to not be on social media.
Yeah.
Are you wasting time? I think that some of you probably are, and I have a solution for you. Nobody wants to do any type of admin. Now, I have a solution for you, and it is called Tradeify. It's a fully automated job scheduling, invoicing, and quoting all in one place. Now, that software is going to save you 12 hours a week, and all by using a simple software solution. Now, you can try it for 2 weeks absolutely free, no cards needed, and you'll even get support in person from Tradeify themselves. Now, when you're done, you can always come back to me and thank me, but just enjoy the extra 12 hours that you're going to gain from just using the software.
I've gone from no social media to suddenly I'm getting to know the CT1 guys. Suddenly I'm getting to know these other 30 people from various different places, you know, Fix Radio, things like that. Yeah. And suddenly loads more doors are opening. And here I am now, having built on that a year later, and things are kind of coming in left, right, and center. I'm signed up with On The Tools now as well.
How are you? Because you would use at the awards, weren't you? Did you win? No, did you not?
I don't care.
clearly you don't.
So you're not a fan then.
In that I don't care, I didn't win. I was one of four finalists for Landscaper of the Year.
Okay, brilliant. Well done.
That's a hell of an achievement.
Who was your?
The guy who won was Hardscapes, and his work is phenomenal. You know, I follow his work and I look to his work for inspiration. I'm never going to win that against him. He's an amazing tradesman.
I'll probably know what won that for him.
Right.
I would say he's probably rolling a Stabilia level. And
I think you're right.
Yeah, because I don't know if it was that job. It might have let you down by just, you know, his fences might be level. We're gonna touch on that.
Yeah, I think that we've been teasing it all episode, haven't we?
Yeah. So we was chatting before we started the podcast, and we was talking levels with Ollie about tolerances and how they are. And Tom just said that he'd done a job the other day where.
It wasn't even the other day, it was Wednesday. And I've not been on site since then because it's been hammering down with rain.
So go on then, so what's going on there? So this is just to it's basically tying you both in because it wasn't a Stabilia
because
level.
Ollie's going to give me a new level.
Basically I'm trying to get you a new level here, Tom. So you've gone to do some fencing, so but this is key to tying
so it's
him
really,
there.
Really basic, straightforward stuff. The posts were already in, had 3-4 hours spare waiting for delivery. End of the day, I thought, right, I'll get something done. I'll get on my rails along for the fencing. And it was about probably 40 meters in total, but I was doing a 20 meter run. And I got to the end and it just didn't quite add up with the side of the garden that I'd already done.
Well, you just stood back, looked at it, and went.
Stood back, like, what is going on? And I made myself a cup of tea and I just sat there and stared at it. And I couldn't for the life of me work out what was going wrong. Put my level on it, bang on, it's in the middle. What's wrong? Go check the other end of the fence. It's bang on. What's the problem?
Your level's telling you.
Spin the level around.
Yeah.
And it's about 10 mil out. And this is a 6-foot level. And to be 5-10 mil out over 6 foot is one thing.
Yeah.
Over 20 meters, that's a good 10 inches or so out. And it was pretty obvious. And what had happened is going back to the story about the Stabilia levels and why I should have bought one of those is the bubble in the middle had moved. So the actual housing that is held in my level had shifted just by a couple of mil.
But one side it's fine, it's level.
So I don't know how well the cameras can see, but the bubble is perfectly between the two lines. All the way along the fence, the bubble is perfectly between the two lines.
Because you're doing it with, say, the writing on the front. I'm doing it that way.
This bottom edge is, of course, on my timber, and it's, as far as you know, level. And obviously the bubble is how you check it. But because the bubble housing was slightly tweaked, it appeared as though it was right in the middle, but actually it was slightly like that.
Yeah. But I you've mean, spun the level 180 that. Degrees round. Yeah. So what causes that then, Ollie? Is that how can it be level one way? Surely those.
So it was never level. So it just gave a false reading because the actual housing was slightly askew.
But then when you spin it round, it's showing slightly off, isn't it?
So it said the opposite the other way around.
Yeah.
So like where it looks level there because the level is slightly that way, spin that round and then it makes it look really even more exaggeratedly wrong the other way.
And that's down to the house, like we said out there, didn't we? That's the housing.
Lesson learned. But that's Spieler, everyone.
But that's going to cost you, isn't it?
It's going to cost me the time it took to do it in the first place, perhaps 3-4 hours, and another 3-4 hours to pry it all off, pull out all the nails and redo it all.
Just time where you can be earning money.
And that's going to be my Monday morning as well. So that's, I've got to wake up on Monday and go and sort my mistake.
And that is key. And like you said, Ollie, your levels from the cheapest, the basic one, up to the high-end one are all set the same with that resin.
Same way, yeah.
So even had I bought the most affordable Stabila on the market, it would have done a better job than what I thought was a really great expensive level.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a lesson to be learned the hard way.
So Stabila as a company, are they all for how you want to push their brand?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's...
You haven't had the phone call today, go, right, I'm on this podcast. Right, you got to say this, you got to get this in. They just let you...
Yeah, no, they let us crack on. I think the reason we are here now in the UK is to bring the brand closer to tradesmen, and socials, podcasts, things like that are how you do it now.
Yeah,
because that's how people are taking on information and engaging with brands.
So that's why you have your ambassadors.
Very different.
Yeah, not ambassadors with Stabila, are they?
Is it not?
What are they called?
Family. The Stabila family.
Oh, it's like the mafia.
The family.
The
Stabila family.
So you've got Liam and you've got Todd and there's a few others. Is Sam one?
No, so we
he is now.
Why not?
we do a lot of work with him.
Yeah.
Not everything for us has to be about like signed contracts because the more like organic your interactions are and the less it is about exchanging money for us is the better. We like to interact and collaborate with people like Sammy. That's about
as a consumer
into the brand.
As a consumer, I wouldn't base my level on I bought my level. I wouldn't base it on what a salesman says. I'd say, who do I know that does a good job? What do they use?
Yeah,
and that kind of natural influence isn't a horrible word, but that actual genuine influence that people have over people. You respect someone's work, you watch how they do it, you learn from it. And that same applies to workwear, to tools, whatever they're using as well.
Yeah.
If they're doing a great job with that product is clearly fit for purpose.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't you go ahead?
People aren't going to use crap product. You're now not going to use what you was
using. Not going to use that level again, am I?
But then other people will then see you using a Stabila level.
Yeah.
And they see the work that you're putting out.
I will probably make a point of explaining why that's the one I bought as well.
You won't be slagging that company off, but you'll be going, this is what happened. I've been educated on why these do that.
And I mean,
but that gives you credibility then. And that's what people look for. That's why people buy from it, isn't it? It's you're looking for that person with credibility. You've got the actual scenario and situation, and you can explain to people.
No one's perfect.
Yeah, so and it shows your credibility. Explain it.
Exactly.
So yeah,
that's it. Like I've openly admitted I made a mistake. I should have probably noticed before finishing 20 meters, but because it was the same amount of inaccuracy throughout the whole thing meant I didn't pick up on it sooner. But I've owned up to that. I'm going to rectify it on Monday with a decent level. And it's going to be right. And I can learn from that. And other people can learn from that. Check your level before you use it. Does it look like something's bent and broken?
Yeah.
Does it look like your apprentice has stood on it and bent it, So I tell you an entirely new story now.
Go on then.
You've got a rough idea of what's going on. Let me tell you about
the
time.
To put a little cap on it, Tom messaged me on Instagram basically saying, look, and he sent me a picture of like a really flary bloodshot.
This is when we need him to zoom on.
Pink
in
eye.
On me.
If you're watching on YouTube, let's get it on. Yeah, look.
It does look like proper pink eye.
Not looking well.
And he says it's not. I don't know what
for
sort
the first
of party
time,
it was.
For the first time in a couple of months, we were working inside yesterday, and I'm pretty sure my assistant was unleashing some gases on me for this. So Max, if you're watching, this is your fault.
It's his fault. Where's blame, there's a claim.
All joking aside, buy some of these guys. I'm a walking, talking billboard for health and safety because we got rained off the last couple of days. It's obviously been horrible over the country. And I was doing some work for myself at home. So I was cutting corners and I wasn't being as safe as I should. That's a long story short. Lovely new saw. And I was trying to work out how to take the dust bag off. And then it suddenly popped off. And all the sawdust kind of exploded in my face.
Just the real fine stuff.
Of course. Wow. Yeah, so it's like scraping sludgy sawdust out of your eye.
Joking aside, they do look bad.
It's really unpleasant. It still is quite, really like painful and stinging. Yeah. And I've been having eye wash constantly and drops and all sorts. But in the meantime, you stuck me looking like this.
So that's happened. He's gone in your eyes.
So what happens when a load of sawdust goes in your face? You kind of step back and jump back from it, don't you? Only there was a plank of wood with a nail sticking out behind me. So I stood straight on the nail with my left foot.
Was you wearing Crocs?
I was just wearing normal trainers. It went straight through them. It went straight through.
Both
and
feet.
It was a 4-inch nail
just
as well.
One.
So just the one foot. I stepped back, my left foot straight on this nail.
Oh, and we've all done
again,
it anyway.
What's your reaction when you step on something sharp? You jump out of the way.
Yeah.
So I stepped back again. Onto a second nail.
Both
with
feet.
My other foot.
Both feet.
So I'm currently sat here trying to be
pinged up like
lovely
Jesus,
and friendly as
like
I can.
Jesus Christ on
and
a cross.
Yeah, so I'm
big burly garden landscaper, and he's got two holes in his feet,
reduced to a
in his eyes.
You promised you weren't going to tell anyone. I told you not to.
Couldn't help myself. Stuff in his eyes.
So yeah, it all went wrong, and obviously nail fell on the floor, just an absolute mess. So I'm kind of turned up here today, bloodshot eyes, looking really worse for wear, hobbling, not just a limp, it's like kind of a double limp.
It's a double,
bit of
it?
A double limp.
You hobble
so it's
with
kind
one
of like
foot,
a little wiggle from side to side.
Shuffled in like a big penguin.
But yeah. I wasn't going to miss it, you know, I've been a big fan of the podcast for, since day one.
Yeah.
So I was always going to be here, rain or shine.
What about you, Ollie? Have you always done what you do in marketing side of stuff, or have you had a previous job as undertaker or something random like that?
No, I wish I had. I've worked in a pub kitchen for a while, but not.
I think everyone does their time to an extent.
I did when I was at school. I worked in an Italian kitchen.
It's a teenage thing, isn't it? You know, it's the local place, wherever it's close by.
Yeah,
you get
your mate's got that job. I'll get you in washing.
Not a proper job.
That's what I did, wash dishes.
And that's how it started with me. You know, I started as a dishwasher, 14 years old, probably a little bit backhandedly. And I remember my first paycheck was like £12 or something because I'd worked like 1 hour.
Yeah.
Not even that. It would have been 3 hours of like naffle pay. But I just worked off from there. You know, you're in that scenario. You're around that environment. You pick up things and you learn. And if you've got something about you, which I like to think I have, you do pay attention and you do pick up things.
I think
other people stare at a wall.
I think
but
the fact that you're a big hulking bastard goes in your favour. Because
you
were a big unit.
I'll wash
unit.
Up tonight.
Yeah. You're a big unit, aren't you?
It's when the grocery deliveries arrive and you chuck a 50-kilo bag of potatoes on each shoulder and then wander in. Nice. It goes down well.
I bet you genuinely scare people. Because you are fucking hulking, aren't you?
I'm a big bloke.
You like
doesn't mince his words, does he?
Well, we're not here for that, are we?
No, not at all.
Friends, were you, for the
I'm
truth?
A big, imposing guy, but it's just, I mean, growing up with lovely food everywhere, you know, mum and dad running a restaurant, dad's been a chef his whole life kind of thing. I didn't grow up eating McDonald's. I grew up eating like
real
steak,
food.
Like really nice, good food. That's probably why my brother and I are both
genetically gifted units.
That's it. And I don't have time for the gym or anything like that. I've never been to the gym in my life.
Okay.
I just work hard. My exercise is my work, you know.
Dead physical job.
Yeah. And I'm a sucker for one-upmanship as well. So if my assistant lifts two sleepers, I lift three.
The assistant.
I don't like to downplay it and call him an apprentice. Because
but you've massively upsold him now. You're
PA. One, he's not an apprentice.
He's trying to chuck in a sleeper.
That's it. But so that's a whole other thing. Like, I can't get an apprentice because there's no landscaping courses. But that's a whole other issue. And you've been into that topic loads of times on here. But please, somebody listen somewhere. Do something about it.
Yeah.
Aside from that, you know, he grabs two bags of cement. I grab three. He sees me grabbing three. He'll grab three. So I'll grab four. Then. I've always got to just kind of take it to the next
level. Is he a big unit as well, then?
No, he's tiny. I could chuck the three bags of cement on one shoulder and him on the other shoulder
with his three bags of cement.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. But no, he puts the effort in, he tries, and he will, I'm sure, get bulkier as he sticks with the job longer, because he's always trying to keep up with me. He's always failing, but he's trying.
Yeah.
What about sporting for you then?
See, I do like road cycling.
Right.
So completely different, where, you know, your body just shrinks down. So you have like really efficient muscles in your legs. And then your arms just turn into, my friends call them noodle arms.
Yeah.
Because you just have literally no upper body strength at all.
I mean, yeah. My forearm's probably twice the size of yours.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks. I shouldn't have sat next to you.
Sorry.
I think you fucked whoever you sit next to.
If it's any consolation, I would far rather be skinny, because, you know, I've been a fat lad my whole life. It's something I've always dealt with.
But that would be detrimental to your job, I think, if you was, you know, Ollie size.
It gives you credibility. You know, if you're turning up as a landscaper and you, this big lump turns up, you think,
yeah.
It's what you expect from a landscaper. Yeah, it's also what you expect from a
chef. He's going to save money on like the machinery to carry stuff around.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't need a digger. Just crane. Get a really big
I am
spade.
The crane.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's, you're asking for what I did before Stabila. I've pretty much always been doing sales marketing roles for manufacturers.
Right.
So I spent a lot of time working for Dulux. So I worked in worked in paint with big painting contractors.
I thought he was going to say looking after a dog.
I've done that before. That dog got paid more than I did.
I can believe it.
Oh, there's a fleet of them dogs.
No. There was always one big dog and then a puppy.
So stunt
same
dog.
People. It was right. Just two of them. So they had a dog and the apprentice.
I bet that dog pulled in serious money.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It was the face, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
The face.
Yeah. Earned a lot.
And that is the go-to. Soon as anyone mentions you, they've nailed it. The marketing's nailed it. Soon as you mention Dulux, the dog is on
the
air.
I couldn't help but mention the dog. Yeah.
But that is that's marketing gold, isn't it?
But there was one time where you're talking about like my physique. I'm clearly not someone that's working out on site. It helped me actually. So I was over in Northern Ireland, and I was going to see a big painting contractor, and it was in a new build house. Nobody else there at all. So it was a little bit dodgy. It started to go dark. There's no lights on in the building at all. And I said, "Hi, I'm Ollie. I'm from Manchester." And the guy looked at me and he went, "Are you a soldier?" And I just went, I showed him my hands and I was like, "Do I look like a soldier?"
Yeah.
Like, feel my hands. I don't know why that's
what a soldier would say.
He was like,
what a sniper would say.
Yeah. Feel my well moisturised hands. They're really good for typing. I've never seen.
Look at the biro on my index finger.
Exactly, yeah.
Mine are like leather.
Look at that.
Yeah.
It's like full of calluses and all sorts, you know.
So, just for the podcast, I've started doing like putting it on Instagram beforehand. Just before we start filming, has anyone got any questions now? For the last few weeks we've done it, we've had a few questions come in. Turns out Tom put a question in yesterday when we filmed a podcast yesterday. Nate's never seen it. So we either don't know if A, Tom is still, don't know what he's looking at with his manky eyes.
I mean, that was
or
Nate, very real problem.
Or Nate just doesn't know how to work social media, being a podcast producer. But apparently we've got a question. Go on then.
We've got two. Would you consider... I'm not sure it's in your remit, to be fair, but would you consider branching out into different colours?
So different colours for the levels? Yeah. No.
It's your thing, isn't it?
No. So it's the yellow is seen as quite a like synonymous with Stabila. I know it's a colour that's synonymous with others.
Yeah.
But we definitely play about with it on like promotional things. I think it gives you scope then if you're really fixed on yellow is our colour. To do limited edition activity on different types.
You've done it with Unite.
You wouldn't buy a Ferrari that's not ready.
We did the 1,000. SLR 1,000. Was it 100 of them? 100 black limited edition that we gave, the blackouts that we gave away. But yeah, you do a limited run of a gold level or a whatever.
No, that I'd buy.
Well, she might be asking the question because we started to do a teaser a couple of days ago.
Oh,
it's just something dark is coming. So
you're going to be doing something.
You can put two and two together.
I reckon you're doing a black level.
That's going to be a black
version. Yeah, I assume this is aimed at you.
How do you keep your tools from rusting with working outside all of the time?
Everything, you know, you wipe down, you dry it off when you put it away at the end of each day, and you kind of hope for the best. If you get rained on, you're almost at the mercy of the weather. Yeah. There's not a lot you can do. Hand tools especially, you know, hammers, bolsters, that kind of thing, they rust, but they still work perfectly fine with a bit of rust on. Something like a tape measure, they just don't last very long.
So we'll go final thoughts then. So what we do is just a bit of advice. If you want to give anyone any advice coming into the trade, Tom, you know, if they want to get into it or plug your channel.
My advice is let Ollie go first.
Everyone always stumbles with this. But again,
I knew it was coming. I just haven't been able to think about it.
Is it, you know, you want to sort of plug the Stabila channels or just a bit of advice for people, or you want to plug your product?
No, I'd say the biggest advice, and this is like we go around a lot of construction colleges to try and train kids. I think it's an important thing for anybody to be involved with, to be honest. But we start, you know, when you've got a room full of kids that aren't really engaged, they don't really want to listen to you. We started by saying the most important thing to listen to here is about invest in the right tools. You know, you buy right the first time. If you buy cheap, you'll buy twice. You'll buy three times. You'll buy four times. Mm.
Or you'll get a fence that's out of level.
Yeah. And the biggest mistake you'll make is a measurement one. So, you know, across the tools, you should invest in good quality tools, and particularly when it comes to measurement equipment and levels, shouldn't take it for granted.
Yeah,
as Tom will tell you.
Yeah.
Tom's lesson learned.
But yeah, you're right. You know, especially with tools. I know when you're starting out in any trade, you will buy cheaper and build up. But one thing, what you've said, is measurements are key.
Yeah.
So, you know, decent level, decent measurer. Go on, Tom.
Transparency. That's my final thought. Yeah. And I mean that in lots and lots of different ways. So you're not sure how to do something, don't be shy. Get advice. Ask someone. If you have made a mistake, own up to it. Resolve it. If you are trying to hide something, then obviously there's something you need to change. So be transparent. Confront your issues. Even if that's, you know, away from the tools, if you're stressed, if you're struggling, if you're tired, don't bottle that up and hide it. Be transparent, talk to people, tell people. It applies to everything in life, you know. Be open, be transparent, share your issues, share your problems, but also share your successes and, you know, the good things as well. You don't just have to hide away and be shy.
Be proud of what you do,
but also the opposite.
Yeah.
Own your mistakes.
Yeah.
Everything that happens in life happens, and one way or another, it can be resolved. If that's money, troubles, mental health crisis, broken tools, messed up fence, whatever it is.
Nice. Enjoyed that, boys. Cracking one. Sorry about that, Gavin. But yeah, it's been good.
Been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
No, not a problem. Cheers, boys.